When Trish Hall was editor of the New York Times op-ed page, she and her staff got 800 to 1,000 submissions every week. They came from celebrities, heads of state, and ordinary people with an opinion. She's seen a lot of good writing and bad, and she's made writing that starts out, meh, really shine. Now Trish Hall has published a book called Writing to Persuade. So Trish, what was it in your experience that made you decide, I have to write a book about this?
Well, you know, I started out incredibly sort of sincere and earnest, and I'm going to read every single thing that comes in. That's ridiculous because I also had a department to run and a lot of things to do. And you realize after a while that if the first paragraph isn't really good, I mean, indeed, sometimes if the subject line isn't really good, you just aren't going to keep going. It's possible that buried in that piece would be something valuable, but no one's ever going to get there. So I think it was day after day of seeing how really smart, really interesting people undercut themselves.
Some of the mistakes people make, the most common, say four of them that you've seen as an editor, they try to cover too much ground in an op-ed. They write in generalities, write complicated sentences that need to be pruned. This is something we have to be especially careful of in broadcast. Or they use so much jargon that what they're saying is unintelligible to anybody outside their field. Another thing you say is that it was people who were well-known in some cases, very influential, sometimes writers who made these very mistakes.
Yeah, I think that just because you're good at writing a novel doesn't mean that you can write a really effective 750-word op-ed. And just because you're a brilliant speaker, it's the same problem. I think there are a lot of really brilliant people in academia who are so used to the language of their field that when they try to reach out, they have trouble speaking in everyday conversational English.
And do you edit them?
Oh, yeah, we edited them, and a lot of people were fine about it. Some people hated it, and they would just walk away. But, you know, op-ed was an interesting balance because when you're an editor in the newsroom, you're in partnership with the reporter, but really the editor has the final say. When you're doing op-eds, it's the work of an outside contributor. So we would check the facts, and we would, if we had disputes over the facts, of course, they had to be right. But it's their piece. And so if we edited the piece in such a way that they didn't feel like it was them anymore, they would just withdraw it, and that was certainly their right.
And then you'd wait and see if it showed up in another big-name newspaper.
That happened most often with celebrities who really didn't want to be edited at all. And, you know, it's totally understandable because they can go anywhere. They have millions of Twitter followers. They're on Instagram. They don't need a place like the New York Times the way they might have once needed it.
But you still get lots of offers from celebrities who want their words to appear on the op-ed page of the New York Times. You specifically write about Bono, the rock singer and humanitarian. Would you tell us the story about when you got a submission from him?
He had contributed a series of pieces to op-ed before I was there, and I think people, you know, thought he was good. But I think that was the one that suffered from just being too general. Like, maybe it was poverty in Africa, and we have to spend billions, we have to fix it. I mean, everybody kind of knows that there are certain big problems in the world, and if you go at them in a very general, comprehensive way, you're usually not saying anything new.
So you ended up rejecting that op-ed piece, but then you got, I think it was a week later, another submission from Bono, who was writing with Mark Zuckerberg of Facebook, and
right.
You took a different approach to that. How come?
I don't know that it was a different approach, but it was a different result. It was the same kind of problem, or it was too general, and I asked if they could be more specific and really dig into a certain aspect of it, and they did, and I thought it was much better and runnable. I mean, you always have this funny balance in journalism where you want, you know that people want to hear from famous people, so you want them, but you don't want them if they're not going to be saying something that feels newsworthy.
I think a good example of that was when Angelina Jolie, the actress, wrote about her decision to have a double mastectomy because her BRCA testing, the genetic testing, showed that she was predisposed to breast cancer and ovarian cancer. But a key ingredient in this, you write, was that Jolie was willing to go personal.
She could have just written a piece about the BRCA gene and how it, you know, is it something everyone should be tested for? It could have read like a public service announcement, which is fine. But she really exposed herself. I mean, she's a very glamorous actress writing about having her, you know, surgery. And I think that because it was so personal, a lot of women could identify with it. And I think by doing that, she did a lot of good.
A lot of people listening to this might think, gee, I would love to have an op-ed in the New York Times or even my local newspaper, but they're not sure where to begin, not sure how to formulate an opinion on the page or even in speech for that matter. What do you say to them?
I think that they should always start with what their experience is and what they know. If it's somebody who has strong feelings about how you can reach peace in the Middle East, unless they're somehow a diplomat or involved in the peace process, the odds of that being published are pretty slight. What people need to do is look at what they have to say, what they've experienced, what they've learned. You know, maybe they hike a lot in the woods near their house and they see certain changes in the ecosystem of the woods, and that brings up some larger issue about the environment. Like, I'm not saying they just write about their walk in the woods, but they need to start with what they know. And I think the great thing about media now is there's so many outlets. There are so many places that will take opinion pieces. There's so many great digital places to go that if people have ideas, it's a great time to try getting them out there.
A lot of venues, but not a lot of editing. And I think that often there are many words that don't add up to much. I think you probably have seen that as well. And I wonder what writers can do about that.
Sadly, I think that people have to learn to edit themselves. I mean, they might be lucky and get a good editor, but I think they have to be pretty rigorous with their own words. They can show the piece to a friend. They can wait a day and read it aloud to themselves. And they just need to go over it and eliminate extraneous words and really try to be their own editors, because they won't always get good editors.
And it's not just about opinion, even though it's an opinion piece. You have a chapter, When Facts Matter, Even Though They Don't. How do you use facts in a persuasive and relevant way?
Every opinion piece has facts, and at the Times we would always check the facts and make sure they were right. But there's a lot of false information out there, and they've done studies that show that false information travels more quickly around the web than accurate information. So it's pretty discouraging, but you need to have your own facts be right, partly because if you're really trying to be persuasive and some people in your audience notice that you get something wrong, they'll discount what you have to say. So it's a very odd mix where it's often emotion and storytelling that are more convincing to people than facts, or people just, they choose to believe the facts that match their own opinions.
So what do you do about that? Because a lot of people also don't want to be persuaded. You know, they don't want to be thinking that they'd been wrong all this time about something. How do you address that?
I think that you can only start changing people's minds by sort of listening to how they feel and understanding what their value system is and thinking about, given their value system, what might make them look at a certain issue differently. One of the people I really admired, who's the person who actually gave me the idea to write this book, is Arthur Brooks. Now, he was the head of the American Enterprise Institute, which was a conservative think tank. One piece in particular I remember where he was writing about how few social scientists at universities are conservative. And he was basically making the case that they're discriminated against. But he did it in such a way that he played into the sort of classic liberal value of fairness, and liberals tend to be against discrimination. So I felt like he was very good at thinking about what his audience would find disturbing and then sort of turning it around and saying, well, do you think it's okay to discriminate against conservatives? And so I think that is a very important way to reach people to understand what their values are.
Trish Hall is the former editor of the New York Times op-ed page. Her new book is called Writing to Persuade. Nice to speak with you.
Thanks very much.